All right, everyone. So welcome to episode 37 of Perigee Podcast. I'm your host, Chief Master Sergeant of the Space Force, John B9 Bentivania. And today I'm here in the Pentagon with a special guest, Colonel Nick Haig. And joining us virtually from Hawaii, yes, Hawaii, though it is an odd hour, is Sergeant William Wallace from the 4th Space Operations Squadron, who's out there, TDY. Today, I'm excited we'll be discussing experiences of both of these phenomenal guardians, because they've done some work with NASA, and they've also just done phenomenal work as guardians for the Space Force. So I wanted to get a chance to sit down with and chat with them today and kind of actually make sure they met one another, since they're both kind of connected with NASA, and kind of share some of their thoughts and have a really good engaging conversation for all of you out there who like to listen to the Perigee Podcast. So I'd like to start really quickly, because we're getting into it, but I would ask Colonel Haig and Sergeant Wallace, Sergeant Colonel Haig, if you could just briefly kind of introduce, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then I'll ask Sergeant Wallace to do the same.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Chief. It's great to be able to sit down and just chat with you a little bit and share a little bit about my experiences. I'm super interested to talk to Sergeant Wallace about his, because other than the short little article that I was able to read about his experiences, we hadn't crossed paths at NASA. So, surprise, NASA's actually a fairly large organization, roughly the same size as the Space Force. And we just have been working in different aspects of it. So I've spent the better part of the last 12 years down in Houston as part of the astronaut corps, training and then flying a couple missions up to the International Space Station. Most recently, just landed a little over 2 months ago after spending 6 months on the station and as part of Expedition 72 and doing science research in microgravity and also floating around and having a little fun doing flips and twists and enjoying zero G.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to get into questions about the research that you were doing there. Thanks, sir. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right, sir. So, Sergeant Wallace, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself, you can take out, we eating maybe pineapple for breakfast or did your swim this morning, but I appreciate you calling in. But if you just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Absolutely. I'm a payload engineer currently at the 4th Space Operations Squadron. My primary jobs are software updates for the payload, critical commanding, response in case of any issues that happens with the satellite. As far as NASA goes, it's odd because I've never worked for NASA, as in they've never directly employed me, but I've worked with entities that were funded through NASA research grants, so that's probably an additive of why we've never crossed paths. I worked with AMU, American Military University, through their Analog Astronaut Research Group, and they were funded through a rapid response research grant from NASA to do these studies that I was lucky enough to be a part of. Aside from that, I have a wife and 4 kids, and trying to juggle all of those, it keeps me fairly busy.
Yeah, life can be life can be challenging sometimes when you're guardian, research, working for NASA, father, husband. Yeah. Well, hey, I am very much interested, just like Colonel Haig, to talk more about the research that you did. But before we get into like the deep discussion, specifically about experiences that you both had. I wanted to just kind of maybe start with flatline and Colonel Haig, if you could talk about, NASA and the Department of Defense and Space Force are two completely separate organizations, mm-hmm. two very different missions, but there are interconnections, right? There's relationships there.
Yeah, they're in the same domain.
Yeah. But for the audience, if you could, from your perspective, since you've kind of, you're sitting here in your NASA flight suit, mm-hmm. As an active duty guardian, but if you can maybe explain, just some of the differences and between the two organizations and also a little bit how they work together.
Yeah. So it's the difference between the national security aspects of space and the civil aspect of space. So the civil mission is to explore and to discover. And that's what NASA is charged with, doing scientific research to continue to push the boundaries of where we've been able to take ourselves as a civilization. Probably the biggest thing that anybody thinks of when they think of NASA is landing on the moon. And, you know, that's that type of exploration that's taking places where we've never been, technologies we've never dealt with before, and pushing the boundary of what's possible. And we're getting ready to go back to the moon. The Artemis II mission is going to launch within the next year and next 12 months, and it's going to send four of my friends around the moon and back again. And that's what we do. That's the civil mission. That's the civil aspect of NASA. So the question is, how does a Space Force Guardian end up working at NASA? And so there's a long history of the astronaut corps having a component of it that is got a military background. And so there's an agreement between the Department of Defense and NASA so that if a military member is selected as part of an astronaut group, then your assignment is over to NASA, and then you work for NASA, and NASA reimburses the Department of Defense for your time. So I've been working for a civilian space agency, like I said, for the better part of a decade. But NASA can't do what it does if the domain of space isn't stable, if it isn't secure. And so that's where the overlap really happens, is we can't do any of that fancy, you know, sci-fi space exploration and all the glitz and glam. That doesn't happen unless the Space Force does its mission.
Yeah, you know, I used to go and visit the 18th Space Defense Squadron out at Vandenberg. And on the older ops floor, and I'm sure you've had a chance to see it, when you'd go there, they would have the signed portraits of whatever astronauts were on International Space Station at the time. Because I think even still today, there's like a NASA representative that sits on the ops floor. We talk about space domain awareness, collision avoidance. I mean, there's a lot of connective tissue there to kind of keep NASA apprised of what's happening in the domain.
Yeah, no, there's a hotline straight to Mission Control in Houston to one of our consoles so that we can constantly keep track of, hey, is the station safe? And, you know, today more than ever, it's routine that we are getting notifications. And so we've got this heightened sense of there's more stuff out there. And then more than ever, we're moving the station now because it is just become more congested. One of the things that I noticed, you know, my last mission was 6 years ago. Biggest difference I saw looking out the window 6 years to this year is just the number of satellites I can see.
Yeah.
Right as we're getting ready to cross over the horizon into daylight, any of the satellites in front of us will glint, especially the ones that are in LEO, right at roughly our altitude, which happens to be Starlink. And so I'll see, it looks like this swarm of fireflies on the horizon as things are crossing in front of us and around us, and it's just mind-boggling how much stuff is up there, and that's all changed within the last 6 years.
Yeah, I think right now, I think the SDA stats that come out, the unclassified, it's almost 48,000 objects I think we're tracking on a daily basis as a service. You know, it's interesting, sir, as you explain that, you know, as Guardians predominantly, that we're looking at screens and data.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about those objects that are orbiting, you talk about, you know, Starlink and LEO, and to hear you describe it, because you're actually seeing it, is just a very unique perspective that as a Guardian that you have.
Well, it just,
that's phenomenal.
It makes me, my sense of faith in the service and Guardians to do their job and keep me safe is, you know, just even more solidified, because you see all that out there and you're like, at some point I trust you guys. you let us know when we need to move, but there's a lot of stuff out there.
Yeah, well, thanks, sir. I appreciate it. And I did get a chance on some of the videos that you recorded for us. May your office view, your office window up there is phenomenal.
I have to admit, it's the best office view there is.
Yeah. Hey, you know, Sergeant Wallace, you know, it's funny, and you're saying that you and Colonel Lee hadn't had a chance to kind of meet or connect yet. But it's funny, as I was thinking, you know, it's almost like the reverse of you know, when I tell somebody that I'm in the military or in the Space Force just itself, and if they know a Guardian, they'll say, oh, do you know John, who, you know, he works down, and they think we all know each other. And I fell into the same trap. I just assumed, like, wasn't it like a big NASA, like, office party where everybody gets together and you know, everybody kind of knows one another, you know, at the water cooler, you know, chatting about what's going on. But Sergeant Wallace, you know, a little more detail, because we had spoken previously, and it's really interesting, but for the benefit of Colonel Hagan a larger audience, you know, some of the work that you did and leveraging your background, and if you can maybe explain why you specifically got into the research based on your background that you did for NASA and kind of where that's going into the future.
Absolutely. So I was in a master's program for aerospace science and space studies, and a lot of the people in those programs that are extremely excited about space and space exploration and how we can do the things that we want to do to explore other planets, most of them had a background in mathematics, physics, engineering, or other tangentially related space disciplines. And I was lucky enough to be diverted from biology as my undergrad to space studies and aerospace science for my master's. So when I applied to do this analog research program, they saw that I had a bachelor's degree in biology. I was pre-med. I worked with plants before. I had this botany background with my classes. And they said, that's something that we could really use when studying spirulina and microalgae and how it interacts with plant growth and how it can leach perchlorates and sulfates out of lunar and Martian regolith, specifically Martian regolith. But I think that was the key, getting my foot into the door. They actually, it's a funny story. When I applied to be a mission controller. So I was going to be someone on the other end providing textual help in a simulated 20-minute delayed comms environment. And they saw my application and they called me and they said, hey, would you actually want to go in the habitat instead of just being delayed on the computer? And I was like, absolutely. So very lucky in that aspect.
How long were you in for?
I was in both of them for about 14 days on the first one, about 7 days on the second one. Mm-hmm. So very short term. Nothing crazy long. I believe it takes 30 days for NASA to consider it a long-duration mission, something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, that's the arbitrary line that we draw from a planning perspective is 30 days for long duration. But, you're up there at that point long enough, you adapt after a couple weeks. So I think, you know, in terms of adapting to that isolated environment, 7 days, you've kind of hit a plateau, at least where you can understand what the significant challenges that are going to be, you know, especially from like just a psychological perspective of being in there with. How big was your crew?
It was three people, including myself for the first crew, and then four people, including myself for the second crew.
Yeah. And did you get to train at all beforehand, or did they just, hey, introduce each other as we shut the door and good luck?
So we had meetings for about a year prior.
Okay.
They were mainly virtual. We had some team building exercises, the best you can do when you're not in person. And then we had a few days prior to the mission where we had dry runs and rock drills on like what we will be doing while in there. And this is the actual hands-on equipment that we talked about for the past year.
Yeah, no, it's I mean, that's so interesting. The analog environments are so important for us to be able to understand what the real challenges are going to be. You know, you're experimenting with comm delays, you know, on the station. Our comm delay is on the order of a second. So it's basically no delay at all, which allows us to, you know, I could call my wife and kids anytime I wanted to, and you could do that with video. And so the connectivity is amazing. That there's going to be a lot of challenges as we go deeper and start to get those comm delays.
Absolutely. If you don't mind me changing the topic, I had a question or two for you, Colonel Haig.
That seems fair. If you get a question, then I get a question. And then Chief gets a question. We'll balance it out.
Deal. In your military experience, what do you think you've done that prepared you the most for your journeys up to the ISS?
You know, I when I think about all the demands on the station, I think everybody initially focuses on like the technical aspects, you know, all the things that you've got to learn, all the equipment you've got to be familiar with. And so then you start to think back, well, what was the technical development along the way? But I would argue that, especially on longer duration missions, the most important things are the interpersonal skills and how to handle challenges collectively and individually, and how to be a good teammate and support, you know, your teammates and help, you know, team care, but then also self-care and all these soft skills that you pick up along the way through a military career, just working in small teams and facing adversity and coming through it. I think that's really the thing that I leveraged the most while I was on station.
Hey, Sergeant okay. Wallace, if I okay, could, I'd like to ask you the same question because, you know, I think Dr. Biller, who was one of the leads for the Biosphere 2 project that you worked on, alluded to your experience as a guardian in the Space Force kind of uniquely prepared you for the roles and the leadership that they wanted you to do in Arizona, I think it was Biosphere 2, right? That's where you were?
That's right.
Yep. So in your perspective, kind of question back at you, because that was something that the leadership that you were work with alluded to. Where do you think your experience prepared you to be successful in the work that you did?
I think Colonel Haig hit it right on the head. I was thinking about it as he was answering it. I don't mean to copy his answer, but while I was in both simulated environments, there's a massive influence on from the military culture, not just because I was there, but because in the forced environment, all three of us were active or prior military members. And in the second one, we had Major Gonzalez, who was is an Air Force pilot, and he had fantastic leadership, fantastic soft traits. And I've learned so much from my team that while I was in there, I just felt like I had to do the best that I was capable of doing, or else I would be letting them down.
Yeah, you know, it's phenomenal when you think about, and sometimes, you know, I think either in all in our careers at maybe one point, or you meet individuals mm-hmm. who when they talk about, hey, we're going to send you to PME, or we're going to give you a leadership, you know, opportunity, and kind of invest, and you're like, oh man, like I got to do this again. I don't want to read this book. I don't want to go to the class. But when you think about the investments that service has provided us, and the skills that are not just applicable to the roles in uniform as warfighters we have to do, but just in general life, that the benefit of that, and sometimes you're too close, you can't see it. But then I think in opportunities like you're both explaining, to realize what you bring to a team, what you bring to an organization based on the investments and the opportunities you had in uniform is really amazing and impressive.
Yeah, when everybody has to go do it, when it's compulsory, whether it's in correspondence or it's in residence, and at some point, I think as a service, we might take it for granted, but you can't overstate the impact that investment has on creating the raw talent within the service to be able to rise to the occasion and tackle challenges. And that's not pervasive outside of DOD. We intentionally do that. If you go out into the corporate world, it's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, because they're looking for you to bring that already to the, to the table.
And that's what you can bring to the table.
Yeah. Sergeant Wallace, did you have another question for Colonel Haig? I know you said you had a couple.
Yes. I absolutely did, and this one is a two-parter, if you don't mind me trying to squeeze two questions out of the same one.
Go for it.
So I've read, I don't want to say a lot, but I've read quite a bit about you, and I don't know how much is true, because, you know, you can't believe everything that you read online.
That's fair.
Just most of it.
Wikipedia is pretty accurate, isn't it?
One of the things was that you had done up to or maybe more than 150 research projects while up in the ISS.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, One, how did you manage your time between all those individual projects? And what was your favorite individual project and why?
Okay. The second one is really tough to answer because there's so many diverse things that you do up there, and they all stick out for different reasons, but I'll come back to it. How you manage your time is through a gigantic team. It's impossible to do all that on your own. So you've got the small team that's up there, the seven crewmates that are on the space station. But we really don't create our schedule. On the ground, you've got mission control centers that are spread around the globe. You know, there's a half dozen of them. There's one in Houston. There's one in Huntsville, Alabama. We've got one in just outside of Tokyo. There's another one in Germany, another one in Star City, Russia. All of these are constantly executing the mission. And so they're supporting you real time. And so for your schedule for that day, they're helping you adjust. And so if you fall behind, they're helping replan. They're making sure that you've got the right resources you need to be successful for that day. And then there's a mirror of those teams that are planning the next 3 weeks. And they're putting that together in 5-minute increments. And so it is meticulously managed. And so effectively, you've got this team on the ground spread across the globe that consists of roughly 100,000 people that are focused on seven people on orbit executing as high, at as high a level as possible. And so you really feel like you're part of something so much larger than yourself when you're up there. Now the experiment. So I'll go with one that we've got in common. This last time up there, I spent 2 months growing microalgae. And we were doing 2-week batches. I was working with the European Space Agency, and we were adjusting some of the conditions each time after a 2-week cycle in terms of the nutrients that we were providing to the microalgae. And why are we concerned with microalgae? I know you were focused on, hey, how do we turn what is pretty barren soil, into something fertile that could support growing crops. On board the space station, we're looking at it as, hey, how can I create a large nutrient mass and maybe just consume the microalgae as food? The other aspect of it is the microalgae consume carbon dioxide. And so if I can have a large enough bioreactor, they can support the humans that are up there by producing oxygen and then consuming our carbon dioxide and basically replicating what we have on the surface of the Earth. So we do lots of experiments up there like that. So that's fun.
Yeah. Hey, so Sarah Wallace, talking about the algae experiment, and I think we had spoken about this, but, I think you had said one of the reasons that you were trying to see the algae grow in a regolith in that barren environment was for nutrient sustainment. Could you talk a little bit about that? And then I think you said you tasted it as well. Tell us about that.
I did taste it. Don't tell the doctors that.
We'll have that stricken from the podcast.
Did you ever taste your microalgae, Colonel Hank?
And they never let me. Even some of the large vegetables that we grow up there. This time we grew a couple growths of just large romaine lettuce, and we harvested it, and then they made us freeze it and send it all home. So we didn't even get to eat the lettuce.
Oh, well, that's a shame. The algae that I tasted wasn't the best. One out of 5 stars.
That's not a great description. You got to use some textural. Was it slimy? Was it chewy? What is eating algae really like?
It tasted like dirty water. Chief Benign, he mentioned that we could add some hot sauce to it, and that would make it taste better. I think he's onto something there. I think that might be what we have to do. But to answer the nutrients question, we were working with spirulina, which is a type of cyanobacteria, like a blue-green algae. And it was selected because it's used commonly as a dietary supplement because it has high micro nutrient value. It's not huge in macronutrients, but it does have, it rates on the macronutrient scales. It's not calorically dense, but it does have calories associated with it. But it's something that's fantastic as an additive to make sure that the vitamins in whatever caloric staple you have, it has vitamins, right? You could subsist solely on spirulina, but that would be a challenge, and I haven't actually looked into the side effects of doing that. So I'm not sure how long you could sustain yourself on spirulina as an algae monster, you know?
Yeah.
Outside of that, we were utilizing it for growing microgreens in Martian regolith, and they were really interested in the perchloroid uptake and the sulfate uptake from the regolith into the plants to see how toxic the plants might be if humans consume them. And I think they're looking into right now, since there was uptake, how many crop rotations, if that's the way you want to go, would it take to extract however much toxic chemicals out of the regolith before you can grow a crop that's viable to eat?
That's pretty amazing when you think about, you know, and this goes back to the NASA mission about exploration, you know, this long-term planning, right? As we go back to the moon, go back, you know, to go to Mars, how do we sustain? Right? And it's these projects like what you were doing up in space and on the station and the stuff that Sergeant Wallace was doing out in the biosphere, that's the foundational to answering those questions.
Yeah, and to take it a step further, every time we try to push a little further into that unknown, we end up learning about ourselves and our you know, the world around us. And so this idea of microalgae and how do I make soil healthy, you know, that's directly applicable to food security here on Earth. And so it's not just about exploring space. It's about all the benefit of the knowledge that we gain along the way to be able to improve life back here as well.
Yeah. Hey, sir, I wanted to ask you a question, kind of shifting gears a little bit. You know, we talk about resiliency as guardians. We talk about the importance of training. You know, the training should be harder than the mission, and thinking through all contingencies so that, you know, first of all, you know what to do when things happen, but also mentally, emotionally, physically, that allows you to continue on with the mission when something necessarily doesn't go right. I think it was 6 years ago when, you know, one of the launches went awry and you wound up ejecting. Yeah. Obviously, that's a catastrophic event. If you could maybe just share a little bit of the, you know, the how, you know, the training prior to that allowed you to, you know, safely, successfully kind of do that. And then, I mean, not soon after that, you went up to the station, like you relaunched.
Yeah. You know, so you hit the nail on the head. It's about the training in advance. The rigor of the training being to the point where in the moment you reflexively fall back on the training to get you through what's going on. And, you know, so the 30-second set the stage, launching on my first mission into the International Space Station, fall of 2018 on a Soyuz rocket out of Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. You know, a Russian rocket, you're sitting there. I've been training for the better part of 2 years in Star City, just outside Moscow, so that I am, you know, comfortable enough to be able to read all the Cyrillic on the displays, understand what it means, issue commands, and talk on the radio in Russian. And so there we are. Alexei's sitting, you know, next to me. He's my commander. It's the two of us with an empty third seat that has some supplies in it. And we launch. It's a beautiful fall day, and we are about 30 miles up, going about 4,000 miles an hour, and that's when the first staging occurs, where the external tanks will separate off the core stage. One of those fails to separate properly, and recontacts and impales the core stage, causing the rocket to tumble and disintegrate. When you're going 4,000 miles an hour, everything happens fast. And so within, you know, a fraction of a second, the rocket has disintegrated, but simultaneously the escape system has detected that the rocket was not going on course. and it pulled us and the fairing away from the rocket. And so we basically just lofted up on a ballistic trajectory, suborbital flight. You see them, you know, Blue Origin's doing them all the time.
Yes.
I got to do that. 3 minutes of weightlessness and then fall back down to the Earth. And so when that happens, it was a sudden kind of jolt side to side, get your attention. There's a red light that starts flashing saying you've got a master caution going off. And then there's a small light that says you've had a rocket failure. And at that point, it's, you know, the quick thought that goes through the mind is, oh, well, that just happened. And 6 months before in a simulation, we had run that scenario once before, so I'd at least seen it once. And so you just get in the procedures. And you know that at that moment, to maximize my chance of getting back down safe and back to my family safe, it's run the procedures as you know, by the book as I can, and work with Alexei. And you know, fortunately, we landed on the ground. Pararescue jumpers, the Russian rescue forces, were there within minutes. You know, and I walked away with a bruise on my knee, and that was about it. And
it's amazing.
But you compartmentalize all of it, and so it's after they extract us from the capsule that I'm sitting on a parachute that you can just feel the wave of shock go over you. And you realize, you know, I'm human. I've got emotions. You can only bottle them up for so long.
Yeah.
And so that's the challenge, is in the moment, the training gets you through. It's after the moment, how do you process all that stuff? And that is something, you know, you don't do alone. Mm-hmm. NASA's got a phenomenal psychological support team. You know, that's lots of conversations with, you know, my wife, Katie, you know, got to witness all that. My boys were there as well. It's conversations with them. It's relying on professionals and just open communication and really understanding, you know, why are we doing what we're doing? And the importance of what we're doing is what propels you forward. And 5 months later, I hopped back on another rocket, same launch pad, and got to the station successfully.
You know, so when we talk about, they said, the training aspect, the discipline, the trust in your team, you know, and then the importance of the resilience to be able to kind of keep going, right? Because things happen, right? The business that we're in is challenging, whether it be operations out of, you know, Buckley Space Force Base, or, you know, being on a rocket, right, to going up to International Space Station, you know, this is difficult. Like, space is hard, right? General Raymond had said. So that ability to have the training, trust in your team, and the resiliency and fortitude to continue to go when things don't, you know, go as planned, happen as planned, it's just really important when we talk about guardian culture and why we do the things that we do and why it's so important to have a team around you and leverage the team. Like, don't be afraid to, we're all human.
You can say, raise your hand, I need help.
Yeah,
that's okay. And it's so important that those foundations are in place before you need them. Because in the moment of crisis is not the time to be reaching out to somebody that you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily. So we build that foundation early so that when we need it, it's there.
Yeah. Hey, Soren Wallace, you know, you said it was 14 days was the biosphere the second go, 14 days you were in?
No, that was the 7 days. 14 days was the original one in Elma, inflatable Lunar Mars analog habitat up in North Dakota.
Okay, so 14 days, you know, from your experience, you know, and Colonel Haig, you know, talked about usually 7 days you kind of hit that plateau, you know. So the 7 days or 14 days, you know, we've all had times away from home when we deploy, but I mean, that's kind of a different environment you're in. You know, what were your skills when you know, away from, kind of isolated in that environment and then coming back?
Well, while I was in there, I actually reflected a lot on, because there's no electronics, there's no anything aside from one computer terminal that we had 20-minute delayed comms with the people essentially right outside, but we couldn't see them. So there's a lot of time for introspection and retrospection. And I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, this is actually not so bad because it is just 14 days and you can set up that goalpost in your mind if you need to. so you can like trudge through the suck if it really sucks for you. But luckily I didn't have to do that because I had an amazing crew. But with the long duration ones, there's not that light at the end of the tunnel. You can't just, drag your feet until you're at the finish line because it's hard to see the finish line so far away. And I was thinking about how in like basic training when they yell at you for fun, but they break you down to build you up, and it's 2 months. And when you start, you're like, oh, what did I get myself into? I have to go through 2 months of this? It's crazy. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that a little bit. And there's resiliency built into you from the military, and you have to have that as a foundation, but it's definitely fortified and built upon in the services. And that when times get tough, that's what you need. And hopefully your teammates have it too. And if they don't have it, then that's where you come in as their teammate to help them and to get the team through what the team needs to get through.
I think, thanks for sharing that. And just for the record, I don't think MTIs yell at you for fun when you're at basic training. I think there's a method to the madness there. I think
I'm sure there's a
program.
I'm sure there's a purpose. Absolutely.
I want to make sure I have that disclaimer. So next time I go down to BMT, I don't get stuck in a corner by a bunch of MTI hats and the clicks they have on their shoes, the taps. So. Talking about, our approach as guardians, when we talk about, holistic health approach that we have, and Colonel Hay, you talked about, having that relationship and knowing those people. So when times of crisis happen, you have a friendly face you can reach out to. You know, the grit teams that we kind of have embedded, I think has been a real success, and that's our version. I mean, all the services have something on it, but, the grit team, I think it'd been phenomenal in our approach to, but physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, right? Kind of, leveraging the resources we have and gaining those skills. But, in that vein of holistic health, when you're on a station, right? So you still got to stay physically fit. Mm-hmm. And I think you had mentioned this, but, we do our 10-miler run. We did it, at Cape Canaveral the last mm-hmm. couple of years. And I think, I got to
participate virtually on the T-minus 10 miler. I got a caveat, whatever time I submitted, you got to put a big asterisk there because I was running at 70% of my body weight, which makes you feel like a world-class athlete, even though you're not.
Well, sir, you are in good shape though.
But it was fun. It was fun to, in some respects to just connect with the ground in a different way. And so I got to tell you, you're wearing a harness, you're wearing 70% of your body weight on your shoulders and your hips, because that's where the body weight has to go with the bungee system that we wear. By the end of the 10 miles, I was sore and raw but it was this sense of shared, suffering with everybody else that's going through that on the ground and being able to do that up there. So it's fun to connect in different ways.
Did you run it in one clip, 10 miles straight?
10 miles straight through.
Yeah, so this last year and this year, I had the opportunity to participate. And I'll be honest, I ran it, but I ran it like 10 one-mile runs because the team and I were stopping at like the aid stations mm-hmm. and talking to volunteers and thanking them and taking pictures. So it was great to get a chance to connect to the men and women who allowed the 10-mile to occur. Mm-hmm. And that's not an excuse for me to just run 10 one-mile runs. But I was a little easier for me. It elongates it. I'm out there for a while, but it's a lot of fun.
It's a sense of accomplishment at the end of the day of, I think, going through it with a whole bunch of other people. And so in my mind, it's less about time and it's more about the shared experience.
Did you get your medal? Did we get you a medal?
It showed up in the mail. I didn't get it until I landed, but it was on my desk at home.
Okay, Katie's
like, apparently you ran some race while you were in orbit. I was like, yeah, I did.
That's right. If being in space and doing experiments wasn't enough, you ran a 10-mile.
I've got the T-shirt to show it.
That's great. Hey, Sir Wallace, did you get a chance to, have you done that 10-miler down at Cape Canaveral?
I have not, but at Treeboard they do a half marathon around the base. And recently, as in almost a year ago now, they did the Danish contingent rough march. So I've done both of those, and the suck is real, and the feeling of accomplishment at the end is real.
Yeah.
Did you get your badge when you did that? Don't you earn a badge?
I didn't get a badge. I got a certificate.
Okay.
I don't know if I got a badge. I never received one, but it might have populated somewhere.
Well, you got the sense of accomplishment, like you said,
yeah.
And you did it with a group of people, right? A group of friends.
Absolutely. I did it for my friends and the blisters on my feet.
Hey, you know, we've talked a lot about your work so far, kind of that you did with NASA and the research, but, you know, right now you're in Hawaii. Are you able to talk a little bit about what are you doing out in Hawaii?
I'm actually not able to talk that much about it.
Okay.
But it's quite fun, and there's some suck in it, and like everything, we're bonding as a team.
All right. Well, I appreciate the work that you're doing out there.
So this is the challenge of the Space Force.
Yeah.
Is a lot of what we do, we can't talk about. So, Chief, how do we spread the word about what the good things that we know the Space Force is doing, even though it's really hard to communicate some of those critical aspects?
Yeah, you know, General Gagnon specifically has been really aggressive about trying to demystify and mm-hmm. declassify as many things from the threat perspective, but also allowing us then that kind of bleeds into operationally, what can we talk about to counter the threat? So as you know, right, over the last several years, we've come a long way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember when we still couldn't say space was a warfighting domain. And now we said it openly, right?
Yeah.
I mean, General Whiting, as a commander of U.S. Space Command, stood on stage, you know, 2 months ago and talked about the need for, you know, weapons in space, right? You know, the president put out the executive order for Golden Dome saying mm-hmm. on-orbit interceptors for ICBMs. And for us, who've been doing this for a while, it's just a distinct change in national policy and our comfort level to talk about the domain. So I think it's getting better, but still there's challenges. Mm-hmm. But I think when you talk about the progress we've made as a service, you know, General Salsom gave us our 10 Space Force truths. We put out the warfighting framework.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about space control and the need for space superiority. And I think that allows us more and more, though, you know, we can't maybe get into operational specifics, but when we talk about the importance of the Space Force, the importance of the work that Guardians do, our role in not only the American way of life, but also in the lethality of the joint force.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many now more things we have in our toolbox that allows us to talk more openly and specifically about it. And I get really excited mm-hmm. when I out and talk about it. And you know, you and I tomorrow are going to get a chance to talk to Space Force Junior ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go and talk to some of those crowds, you know, I try not to make it like a recruiting pitch. But sir, what I tell them, and you know this, right, is that space has so many opportunities for us as humanity mm-hmm. and as a nation. And I tell them that in their lifetimes, when we talk to these students tomorrow, that it could be with their children or grandchildren when they say, hey, where do you want to go for summer break? I mean, it could be Disney on the moon or Disney on the station. Mm-hmm. And it's Guardians who are going to secure our nation's interest in from and to space. They're going to allow the dreamers to dream,
mm-hmm.
right? The innovators to innovate, explorers to explore. And that's kind of our role in that, to allow organizations like NASA and, you know, the industry that's commercial industry that's tourism and just, space transport.
It's booming right now.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And, you know, like you explained, you know, the what we provide in that environment as Guardians is so critical to allowing that to flourish. And I'm proud of that. I get excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things, you know, how do you talk about the work we do? Well, if you could just our role in just that, you know, unlimited opportunity and the American way of life that we mm-hmm. help to secure, that'll give you enough talking points I think
yeah.
people can connect to. It's really
yeah.
important. So it's an amazing time. And I'm looking forward to tomorrow to
yeah.
the... So one of the questions, so we're going to talk to students. So I have to ask, sir, you've done a lot of engagements, and I think you did several things, even when you're on the station, mm-hmm. But if you could talk a little bit about what were some of the outreach things you did from the station, and what are some of like the craziest questions that you kind of get when you engage, especially with young children?
So, you know, with any audience that I engage with, usually the ground rule I throw out is that, you know, no questions off limits.
Yeah.
And so you get all kinds of you know, the things that you would expect. So you go to a high school and you'll get questions. Well, everybody's interested in just the basics of life. You know, how do you eat up there? How do you go to the bathroom? How do you shower? How do you sleep? Those are the kind of the go-to ones. And some of those are a little more, you know, icky to describe than others. You know, every now and then I'll get somebody that, you know, is, you know, prove to me that the earth isn't flat. You know, they're still out there. And so then we'll spend, usually I spend a good solid 30 seconds to a minute just providing a basic class on here's how an orbit works.
Yeah.
And it's surprising, but even kindergartners can kind of understand the basic concept of if you go fast enough, you go into orbit. So that's a lot of fun. We do all kinds of outreach up there. Everything from ham radio. And I'll do ham radio contacts with classrooms around the globe. And we do video downlinks to different schools, whether that's university level or all the way down into elementary. And then, you know, obviously there's the mass media, and all of them are fun. But I enjoy engaging with students, I think, the most, because they're, you know, young enough that they're still looking, you know, what's my opportunity?
Yeah.
And so there's this idea of, you know, this, you know, anything is possible. And that's fun to see in people's eyes.
Yeah, I'm excited about tomorrow, our engagement. Thanks for doing that. Hey, you know, when you talk about the challenges where people are so interested, like how do you eat, how do you shower, how do you mm-hmm. you know, just do normal functions on when you're on the station. Hey, Sergeant Wallace, when you did your time working in the environment you were in, were there simulated, you know, the normal routines that they try to simulate what it would be like in an exoplanetary environment? Or did you have, like, you know, running water and flushing toilets and, you know, normal things? How did they kind of restrict to trying to simulate that environment?
Right. So they had a water restriction while we were in the biosphere, where we had all of the water that we would be using in one large tank. I believe it was 250-gallon tank, but it was only filled up to about, I'm probably going to get the number wrong, but about 100 gallons. And we had, it was fully pressurized, and there was a huge lung we had to monitor to make sure that the pressure stayed consistent. And we had outflow valves. But aside from that, we had condensers in the air to condense and get the humidity out of the air, and then we'd put that into a filter, filter it through a few times, add it back to the drinkable water. And then we had wastewater, which we didn't manage that in a way that we could reuse it, but that's part of the upgrades that they're using in the SAM biosphere for, I believe that they're shooting for this year or next year, but eventually they want to get like reclamation water and black water and gray water able to be drinkable and portable water, so you can get a fully simulated closed system environment. And how efficiently can you do it? And would this be able to be utilized on Mars? Those are the questions they're trying to answer over there right now.
Did you clothes management? Did you try to wash clothes? Did you just wear them the whole time? Did you wear them a few days and throw them away? Showering?
Yeah, so we were able to do, we had a shower, but we had no running water in the shower. So it was like a sponge bath while you're sitting in the shower. And then the drain would drain gray water, and that would be discarded. But as far as clothes go, 7 days, we just sort of ripened up over a few days, and then we lived with it. Mm-hmm. And then we took a shower about three times, but realistically it would probably be twice, because you want to min-max the water usage.
Yeah, completely understand. That sounds like station life. You were living the analog for sure.
Well, hopefully you smelled a little better than we did.
After a while, you just don't notice. You know, you get used to it. So,
it's amazing. Normal creature comforts, right, that we've become accustomed to. But all of this is part of the exploration and the learning journey for us to kind of make that step, right, for, more presence in the domain, relearning all these things and re-baselining, like, what is etiquette? Like, what's expected? Like, how do you do that? What's a new norm?
Yeah.
Wow, that's impressive.
And it's how you adapt to the environment, and then, when you get up there in microgravity, then all of a sudden your body starts to change, and the thing I walked away, I end up coming away from these experiences with, is just how adaptable we are. And so you talked about resilience. What you expose yourself to every day, those little micro decisions that you're making every day, really end up shaping who you are. And when you have a chance to step into some, environment that is so completely foreign, it really strikes a home, because, like, everything changes. I grew a little bit. I got calluses that moved from the bottoms of my feet to the tops of my feet.
Oh, my gosh.
The hair on your body grows in more full because your clothes aren't rubbing it and wearing it away, because your clothes really never touch your skin. They just float around bouncing off the hair on you. And so all of these little things change. Even down to the cellular level, even the way your mind processes your environment around you. And so we are adaptable. I'm a middle-aged guy, completely felt like I was, warm jello up there as I was adapting to my environment and then readapting once I get back down to the ground. And so we're never done adapting to the environment we're in. Yeah. We're adapting to the environment we're in right now, right where we're at. So that foundation, those little decisions, all the things we expose ourselves to, that makes us who we are. And so as we go into these new places and we do these new challenges, we're going to become different people. And it's up to us to make sure that it's for the good.
It really makes you, Soren Wallace was talking about, the introspective, really gives you a different way of thinking at ourselves. It's amazing.
Yeah. Sergeant Wallace, did you journal at all? I know you couldn't interact with anybody on the outside, but did you try to capture your thoughts on a daily basis?
I did. At first I thought, because I just liked writing, just because mainly my penmanship is so bad. I never read what I write, but I do remember what I write down.
Yeah.
It's a good way of encoding the thoughts that I have.
Yeah, it's a wonderful tool. I did the exact same thing. You can process what's happening to you, and it's a chance to reflect. And so I'm glad you did do that.
Absolutely. I completely agree with what you mentioned when you said that you are, in essence, the accumulation of the micro decisions that you make, because, it really resonated with me. A long time ago, I heard someone say the phrase that specificity is the soul to narrative. And I wish I could attribute that quote to someone, but I don't remember who said it exactly. But that resonated with me for a long time. And when you talked about you are the accumulation of the decisions, the micro decisions that you make, that really resonates with me as well. So thank you for that.
Hey, so question, because I think we're coming to the close, but what advice, Soren Wallace, do you have, and Colonel Hagalix, the same thing, for those aspiring individuals that are so interested, in helping this journey that we're on as humanity, right? This exploration and learning these things, and getting involved with projects with NASA and things like that to help us kind of break the bonds of Earth and go off. So, Soren Wallace, I mean, any advice for individuals who are looking to partake and contribute just like you're doing?
Absolutely. Talent can be found almost anywhere. And if you're interested, it doesn't matter what you're studying most of the time, because there's an aspect of that in space, in travel, anywhere you go. If you're studying psychology, biology, any of the sciences, any of the engineering, mathematics, physics, even art plays a role in topology, which goes into mathematics, and that could be helped through the lens of creativity and solving some of the problems that we have and organizing and thinking about it in different ways. So if you're actually really interested in space and in exploration, I don't think it's ever too late to start down a journey of trying to contribute to that field.
Thanks for that. I appreciate it.
Couldn't say it any better. It's there's a place for everyone. And so find your passion and just chase that passion and it will find a way into this really complicated team. You know, the strength of our team is built on its diversity, you know, diversity of perspective and experience. And so as we bring those different perspectives together, it makes us so much stronger. And so bring your passion to, you know, bring it to the table and contribute.
Thanks for that. I appreciate it. I want to say that this has actually been a really interesting opportunity to speak with both of you. And I think it's because not only, you know, you're phenomenal guardians, right? And we talk about, you know, being on this team, you know, being a guardian wearing a uniform is a profession, right? This isn't a job. And it does shape us, but it doesn't solely define us, mm-hmm. right? And this is a great example of the passions you both have where, you know, you're spending time, sir, working with NASA, though you're an active duty guardian, but this is something that you pursued. And Sergeant Wallace, same thing for you, right? You took those experiences and opportunities that you had prior to, but also leveraging your guardian experience to follow a passion still, you know, working with biology and working with NASA, that it's really important that we all understand and really, if anyone takes anything from the podcast, it's that, right? It's that there's so much for us to contribute and we can leverage our experience in a uniform, but it's not solely uniform only that kind of defines who we are, what we do. Having external passions and interests and having other things that we spend time doing is also just as valuable, impactful, and important. And thanks for sharing your contributions, your passions with the audience and with me today. It really has been a lot of fun. And I wish you both the best of luck as you continue on with your journeys, not only as guardians, but also, you know, as working with NASA and helping us explore, helping us innovate, and helping us dream big. I really do appreciate it. So from the Pentagon and remotely from beautiful Hawaii, we're signing out here. Thanks a lot, everybody. Appreciate it. Semper Supra.